The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.
So, welcome to the podcast, Property Coaching and Wealth Creation. My guest today is Jim Halliburton, and I've known Jim for quite a number of years. Jim's also known as the HMO Daddy, and Jim's got a heck of a lot of tenants. Welcome to the podcast, Jim. Great to talk to you today.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to appear on the podcast, and thank you for everyone who cares to listen to me.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So we've got a number of things that we want to run through in this session, Jim. First of all, I just want to find out a little bit more about what it is that you do exactly. Obviously, you invest in property, but you have a specific type of property that you invest in. Just tell me a little bit more about that, if you would.
Sure. Since 1991, I've invested in HMOs. I started in HMOs. I never started with single lets or anything like that, partly because no one advised me at the time that you should start with single lets and graduate to multi-lets, because there's no courses at the time. Yeah. I was a college lecturer when I started, and that's why I still do a lot of training and courses, because that's really my passion. HMOs are great. I enjoyed those, and over the years I've gradually built up a portfolio of HMOs. Last year I got 27 more HMOs. This year I slowed down slightly because I'm just getting over the hump, and I think I've only acquired 3 so far this year, but we'll see how we get on with the properties. An HMO is a multi-let. It's where you take a house at the very simplest level and let it buy the room. I was quite advanced at the time, where I just take the bedrooms, not only the bedrooms, but the two lounges that you'd have in most three-bedroom houses, and get 5 tenants out of it. And sometimes I split the rooms and get 6. So it's a way of increasing tremendously the income from property by letting buy the room. I started off with students because I was lecturing at the college, and that's the kind of accommodation that was wanted and was desperately short in the area. They had very little student housing in a place called Wensbury, which no one's ever heard of, north of Birmingham, south of Wolverhampton, just to give you a clue. But it had a fairly large college at the time, and they needed student accommodation. And I stepped in. I was very lucky. And I gradually built up. After a period of time, I'd built up to 38 properties, of which about 20 were multi-lets. And I also acquired a number of single-lets because I was told that was the best thing to do. Now, I'm different. I don't bother with single lets, and a lot of the single lets that come back onto the market, I will multi-let if they're suitable. I won't throw the tenants out, but if they come to the end of the tenancy, I'll adapt the property to make it a multi-let. I'm geared up for multi-letting properties, and I've carried on just increasing my portfolio. I left full-time lecturing in 2004 and decided that with 38 properties, do I carry on with my 38 properties, can I easily manage them myself, or do something a bit more? Am I just going to wait with 38 properties and wait for the Grim Reaper? Or am I going to do something in the meantime? And I made the decision that I'd go for at least 100 properties. 2004, okay. I expected the shutters to come down. In other words, the recession to start in about 2005 or 6. So I thought, well, I'll go fill my boots now while we've got available funding, and set the task to buy 50 properties in a year, which is one a week. And that's a big problem. When you set yourself a target and you go for it, you'll achieve it. It's quite frightening. I'm quite terrified by the fact that you can do these things if you put your mind to. It's insane to buy 50 properties in a year, one a week. I was buying 3 or 4 in a week sometimes. Completely insane. You're trying to cope with it all. But the funding was there and you could do it. And I didn't expect the recession to hit, because it carried on and carried on. And George Brown said, end to boom and bust. This is what it's going to be like. And I got caught a bit short when the shutters came down in 2008, which I'd expected to do back in about 2005 or 6. So, yep, carried on. And then last year I picked up again. It's easy to buy property when you know how. Very, very easy in this area particularly. Down London, it's more difficult, the southeast, because of house prices and competition. But here, it's easy to acquire them. And I've got the systems now. I see a property I want, pick up the phone, say to the solicitor, buy that. That's it. Pick up the phone to the valuer, value that. Pick up the phone to the bank and say, I want to borrow the money to buy this. And then I just fill it up and say, go ahead and convert it. So that's hard work buying houses for me.
Yeah. It's the beauty of having systems in place, isn't it, obviously?
It is. It's built up over many years. I'm very lucky. And it's one of the few advantages of being a big landlord. I wouldn't recommend it necessarily for other people. People say, oh, yeah, I envy you, Jim, and I want to aspire to you. Think it through a little bit more than I did. 5 to 20 HMOs, you can manage yourself. And it's easy to do. You ought to interrupt me, by the way, because I'll just carry on talking all the time.
I'm happy for you to carry on. I'll interrupt you when I need to keep control of the conversation. But everything that you've talked about so far is just spot on. And in terms of what you have discussed, I mean, I've written down a number of notes here into questions that I'm going to start asking you. So I will start interrupting you at some point. So the first question I've got for you is, you mentioned that you expected the shutters to come down in 2008 because the recession hit. What happened to you in 2008? I knew a lot of landlords that went bust in that time. How did you survive it?
I suppose because I faced up to the problem. It was very easy. I didn't expect the shutters to come down. I thought they'd just carry on. I got the 50 I wanted by 2006. And found that things were still going on and loans were still to be had. So I just carried on. And then when it came to, I remember thinking, I ought to still be drawing back now. And I had about 12 projects on the go simultaneously. And you can imagine if you are doing 12 projects, expecting to be able to remortgage the deal out. I ought to explain how I'd buy properties. Yeah. I usually go out and buy the property for cash. I usually pay for the building work. And because it's an HMO, it can be, you can get it valued on income. So to give a very simple example, I buy the property, say, for 100. I spend 50 doing it up. It values up at 300,000. The lenders will lend you 70% of that. So once it was up and going, I'd get a check sent to me of 70% of 300,000, which is 210K. I've recovered the cost of the purchase, which is 100, the cost of doing it up, which is 50, and I've got 60K to use for my next project and deal with the incidental expenses. Now, probably unlike you, I didn't fly to Spain and decided to sit on the beach. I just carried on and carried on. And that's why I built up to 12 projects on the go. The shutters came down. I'm stuck with 12 projects. I can't refurbish. These properties need finishing off. I've then got to go back to looking at being a landlord. And that's what you tend to forget. When you're cashing out 30, 50, 70,000 every time you do a deal, you're not worried too much about whether Johnny, one of your tenants, has paid the rent. Yeah. Your focus is off the day-to-day crud of being a landlord, which is very tedious and not particularly exciting, just chasing tenants who don't want to pay the rent, doing repairs, managing the properties. That I tended to delegate it. And when the shutters came down, I had to go back to basics, make sure everyone's paying the rent, cut costs dramatically. When you'd got plenty of money, it didn't matter. You'd got a massive workforce. I had to half the workforce, cut everything out. I'd sat down with the accountant and we just cut all unnecessary and pretty well essential expenditure, just paid the mortgages and the few staff we had. And it was a struggle because I still had to try and get these 12 properties finished so I could get income from them, deal with the ongoing costs. And to be fair, when you spoke to creditors, and you imagine I had a load of creditors at the time, all wanting their money. To give an example of one, probably the one that sticks in my mind, it was Denman's electrical suppliers. They won't mind me mentioning their name because it's all good about them. I had a bill of about 70K. So I just phoned up the chap and I said, can I speak to the head of credit control? I said, look, I'm suffering. He said, yeah, I understand that. Everyone's suffering. I can only afford to pay you X amount per month to pay off the bill. And his comment was, fine.
Great.
That was it. I was just amazed that there were 70K. I'd sat down with the accountant, arranged sort of ways of paying everyone so much per month, and everyone accepted it. No one said, no, don't pay us. No, we want all our money now. They all accepted it, paid them off. It was a long haul. I spent a long time. The only people who caused me problems were some of the lenders who, having lent at, say, 1.5% above base, were saying, well, interest rates have gone up. We lent you at 20 years. That's not good enough. We want to increase our interest rates, or we want you to sell off your properties. And I had a few of those, and I had to fight those off. And I don't mind saying that some of the lenders, the morality of them, leaves a lot to be questioned. I've survived so far. Some of them are still circling. But now the market's picked up, I'm probably in a position of saying, okay, I'll sell those properties off and you can have your money back. Or we just carry on. It seems odd that they'll lend at 1.5%. Then they say, well, because we're lending now at 5% above base, we want you to increase your interest rates to match that. Well, fine. What happens if it goes the other way? I can't go back to them and say I want to reduce it. It's the old saying that banks, they give you an umbrella when the sun's out, and then when it starts raining, they want it back again.
Of course,
that's a phrase. So that caused a lot of stress because I worked quite hard to build all this up. And then you could see that if I got repossessed, I could very easily go bust. So it was, I find it a very depressing time. And that's probably a flaw with me because it's just money. It's all a game. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't just say, well, I'll lose all that. But I've still got my health. I've still got my good looks. Are you saying I'm being delusioned on that one? Don't mind my sex appeal. So I thought, hey ho, it's not a disaster in any way. It's not as though your kids have been harmed or anything. I'd still be there. And once you learn how to make money, you could go and start again. And often it's the first few deals that give you the greatest pleasure. To me, buying another property is okay, but it's a bit like having another chockey after the 120th chockey. It's just has a, you like it and you like chocolate, but it becomes a little bit too much. So 2008 was a bit of a wake up. I then didn't really do very much for a couple of years in the way of buying properties. I just concentrated on looking after what I had. And at the same time, I had enormous change to the type of tenants I had. I went from being totally working only to having to take unemployed tenants. And that was a nightmare because I had no way of assessing it. My staff couldn't adapt fast enough.
And in terms now of those type of tenants, what's the mix?
Well, last year I had 60% unemployed and 40% working. This year it's reversed. We're 60% working and only 40% unemployed.
And why is that? Is that a change in the economy, do we think? Or is it that you've changed your systems and you don't want DSS anymore?
It's not I don't want DSS. Put it this way, if you've got a choice between a working tenant and a DSS tenant, you'll always take a working. And I'm getting, where before I was desperate to have tenants, so I was much more open to taking an unemployed tenant and giving them a chance and all the rest of it. I've now stopped that. It's still with us.
You know, the worst type of tenant is someone who's on benefits and then says, I'm on benefits, but I'll be getting a job because I'm looking really hard. Because it takes, well, unless you've got systems in place, but it can take up to 12 weeks to get the actual money from the council. And then we get a job, so then it's cut.
Yes.
So then you get nothing.
Yes.
And then start paying rent because we've got the job. And then we lose the job, and then we have to apply for benefits again. And it really goes against them. It doesn't help them at all. I don't accept those people who are on benefits looking for a job. Either I want you on benefits or I want you on in full-time work. One or the other, please, not mix and matching, you know?
Yes, I can, you're surprisingly understanding of the problem you have as a landlord. Unfortunately, to me, money is not the main motivation. If someone comes to me and I believe they do want a job, I have a policy of never turning away anyone who's in need of accommodation if they're genuine.
Yeah,
I've never evicted anyone who couldn't pay the rent if they're genuine, except I haven't found such a person. You find that tenants who don't pay the rent, they're either keeping it for themselves to drink it, drugs or other abuse, or can't be bothered to claim housing benefit. We've got a wonderful system in this country. Someone doesn't work, the housing benefit will pay the rent, and they'll pay the full rent for the first 14 weeks. It's an advantage to have someone losing their job because you know you're going to get the rent 14 weeks, provided they make the claim. And a lot of tenants will not make the claim. And I don't understand that logic. I've never been able to delve down to it. But you're right, when they come in and out of work. But I always encourage them to go to work. I think...
I tell you what it is. It's the pain of having to go to the do the forms and then having to go and sit in front of someone is greater than being either made homeless or not being able to get rent somewhere.
I would understand that if they had to do that. But they don't. We do it all for them.
Yeah.
All you have to do is sign the form. We fill them in for them. We sort it all out. There is just a, I don't know, there's something wrong with a lot of people's psychology. They even say, I'm not going to get charity. Oh, yeah? What does that mean? I'm not going to claim benefit. So you mean you're not going to have charity, but that means you're not going to pay my rent either.
Yes, it means you have to be charitable to them.
I know. That's the contradiction you have with a lot of benefit people. But if someone came to me, I said, I want a job. I'm unemployed. I do it with Eastern Europeans all the time. They come here with not a penny. I move them in. If I assess them as being genuine people, a lot of them take advantage of that. But hey-ho, Some don't. And I even say to them, if you come here, you haven't got a job, you come and work for me to earn your money for your rent. And so there's no excuse. Probably one out of five is genuine with that and does their best. Four out of five take advantage. But hey ho, it's you've got to live with your own conscience. You've got to do what you think is right.
I agree.
I have no, absolutely no sympathy for people who just say, "Well, I'm following orders. I've got to do this." You haven't got to do anything. And but then again, I suppose I was lucky. I was a college lecturer. We were given great autonomy. You just decided what was right, what was wrong. If you look back on those days, the management must have had a nightmare where people.
I think things have changed considerably in the education sector these days.
I don't think so. I think people just accept it. Yeah, it's often a door. Or that they try and push, but if you just turn around and said no, they wouldn't really do much about it. I think people create their own crosses and pretend that they have to do things when they don't.
So what's interesting is the way that you've come across so far is that, because there's one thing that you said that really stood out for me, and it was, it's actually not about the money. It's about providing a level of service to help people who actually need help. And in the podcast interviews I've done so far, there's this underlying theme of actually going out and helping people. Now, sometimes, Jim, I don't watch TV, as you probably know, but you've been on TV, and sometimes the way that you come across, or the way that it's edited that you come across, looks like you are just a landlord, stick them in, get all the money out, and it doesn't come across in the best light, in my opinion anyway. But actually, and I think that's down to the way that they edit it, because they try and make it more exciting, they try and polarise the audience, don't they, so they get a kick out of the audience and get it discussed on social media and so on. But actually underlying all that is this idea of, well, actually, if they're up for working and they're honest, then I'm happy to help. Even if they're in a bit of a stick at the moment, I'm happy to go out of my way to help them.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I don't believe anything on television, having appeared on television, and see how they completely distort the whole thing, even though it's supposed to be a drama documentary. It's so distorted. There's some total of 3 months filming, and I was shocked by it. But most people can see through it. Some don't, to be fair, but most of them can see through the side of it all. But yes, I think it's because you recognise you are in a privileged position, and people have helped you in time of need. Go back to the manager at Denman's. He just said he could have, I suppose, screwed me over. He wouldn't have got any money if he'd taken me down, but at the end of the day.
Okay, so one of the other things that you mentioned earlier on was with the electrical company, and that you just spoke to the guy, picked up the phone, spoke to him, and then you negotiated a repayment over, you know, on a week-by-week basis. And I think that's really interesting, because what a lot of people do is they have this problem, whatever the problem is, and then they go and promptly stick their head in the sand and hope it goes away.
Yeah, I was tempted to do that, I can understand. You've got your staff there, you've got your tenants, you owed it to staff and tenants to get up and face up to it. It was a problem I created myself. I've got no excuse. I shouldn't have had 12 deals on the go. I was just being, whether you want to call me greedy or ambitious or making the best use of the talents I've had. So there's a biblical term, but you do things. If I just sat there and said, well, I won't take any risk, I would have done nothing. If you face up to it, and I was quite surprised how most people, apart from some of the banks who can only be described as evil, and I don't know why the government just don't pick up on this. They have a go at banks for lots of things, but what they're doing behind closed doors and in effect bankrupting people is disgraceful. It's appalling.
I think with the lenders, the people that are behind the phones as individuals, they're just people who then are able to make a decision. And when I've spoken to these type of people, it's almost like they have an axe to grind, because in some way you're either more successful than them, or it's like they're trying to screw you in some way to sort of serve you right.
Don't know. Are you talking about the banks now, or are you just talking about individuals?
Talking about banks, but I'm actually talking about the people who make those individual decisions. We had a credit card machine, for example, with Lloyds.
Yes.
And we were sticking through deposits and all sorts of things through it. And so, first month's rent and that sort of thing, it just streamlined my lettings agency that I had a couple of years back. And we were sticking in an awful lot of money each and every month because the lettings agency was very successful. And then suddenly the bank turned around and said, yeah, we want like 30% of wanted 6 months of fees to be held in a bank. This was like a couple of £100,000. And I was like, well, the deposit, that £1,000 deposit, that's not my money. That's the tenant's money. It has to be put into a deposit protection scheme. Well, we want that. Well, that's not your money either. Well, that's not good enough. We'll have to close you. Literally, they closed our account down. And it was just one individual who, for whatever reason, I know what the reason was, it was me, we wound him up the wrong way, let's say, and he was an absolute bastard to us.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's just this one person who's making the decision for the whole bank.
Yes, I've seen that a little bit, and certainly with housing benefits, you get the feeling there's certain individuals who work within housing benefit who want to screw up claims and or pay the money direct to the tenants, and knowing perfectly well the tenants will just drink it away,
or
go back on drugs or whatever. And yes, there's a bit of that. There's a lot of twistedness. When I did an interview for The Guardian, I was amazed that garden readers could be so vitriolic. They had to 99% of the responses that came from the interview, because you look at the whatever it's called afterwards where people make comments, and they had to delete them because they're so abusive. And some that were left were pretty horrendous. This idea, just outright hate against landlords.
Do you know what, Jim? I've got a confession about The Guardian. I don't read the actual article. I just go straight to the comments because I really enjoy those. Because those comments are not aimed at me, they're aimed at someone like you. And I quite enjoy the comments because they're so abusive.
Mm.
And whenever I see that, it motivates me to go, well, screw you. I'm going to go out and buy some more properties and, you know, and help. For me, it's helping tenants effectively find somewhere nice to live. But it actually inspires and motivates me that there's such vile comments from people who have no idea, who will remain poor for the rest of their lives, get, you know, retire at 70 with a golden clock, die 2 years later, and that's their life, you know? When I compare that to how I live now at 42, living on the beach, whatever, it's completely polarized. But I actually enjoy those comments because I get really inspired that there's so many people out there that hate people who want to do better for the world, either make money for themselves, which is great because we've all got families and we all want to put food on our table and want the best education for our kids and so on. But then also we provide a level of service for our tenants, which we want to put them into good quality homes, not with bad quality landlords, which is where they've come from. And yet for some reason, we are the leeches on society, according to Guardian readers, for actually providing that level of service. It's just bizarre.
It is. I don't read them anymore. I rarely read the comments that come back because I find it's too negative. My problem is because I'm in the day-to-day grind of running property and I mix with people, I have to get up and move away to get inspired. And I therefore try and look to more positive areas to spend my time to inspire me. That's why I tend to go on courses. I spend a fortune on courses every year to develop. But because you go on courses, you tend to meet with positive people. Most presenters are very positive people, and it uplifts the spirits. I think, actually thinking about it, I used to go to church when I was a kid, and I don't know why I stopped, because my family started going to church. And that is a sort of positive feeling uplifts the soul, your motivation. The day-to-day can grind you down, and I can see how people get twisted like that. And you've just got to step away from it and be bigger. And it can be hard.
It can be. Your environment's one of the most powerful things and yet one of the most simplest things to change. And you make a small change in your environment and your whole world will change.
Yes. I'll come in.
Tell me more about splitting the rooms in HMOs, if you can. So do you need planning permission to do that?
Oh, you want technicality. It's so easy now since 2010. People just don't realise how lucky you are. 2010, they changed the law and said a house can be up to six. It doesn't say it can't be more than six. It just says up to six doesn't need planning permission unless you're in one of these Article 4 areas, which is a very small part percentage of the country, which is goes back to what it was like pre-2010. I built up most of my properties well before 2010, so I didn't bother with planning permission. Now you don't need planning permission. You can do this as long as you provide a property of sufficient standard, and that's a very grey area, what is considered the appropriate standard. You can split your property up. It's what tenants want. There is a limit to the people who want a small room, but there is a market there. People who can't afford any more than a small room. Young unemployed can't afford much better. If you give them a big room, how could they afford to heat it? I mean, it's very odd, except most of my properties, I provide central heating as part of the rents because I don't want my tenants to be cold. I hate being cold myself, and I provided that for my tenants. You don't get much appreciation for it. There's an old saying, and if you're an HMO landlord, no good deed goes unpunished. But hey ho, you don't do it for the praise or reward. You do it because you think it's right and what's wrong. And I absolutely agree with you. There's a whole environment out there that's anti-private landlord. And it's very strange. I'm paying probably over 200 grand in council tax. If a lot of my unemployed tenants were housed by the state, the cost to the state where they put them into social housing is about 10 times that they pay me. So if I have a tenant who's, say, under 20, 35, the state only pays 60 quid in this week in this area in rent. So they only get 60 quid. Hostels, where they would probably end up if I didn't house them, many of my vulnerable unemployed tenants, I'll say all of them, but many of them would be in a hostel and it costs 600 quid to house them. I reckon I save the local authorities in my area well over £5 million a year. I've never had one word of praise from my local authority. Some actively go out to try and bring me down. Which I find very strange, the complete misunderstanding by the general public that they think private landlords are bad, social landlords are good, yet all the major problems you have in housing are social. They're the social landlords, the social estates, that's the big areas, but they focus on the very small percentage of private landlords where there is a problem. It's a topsy-turvy world. It's a completely illogical world. And our biggest critics are the ones who never housed anyone. You stand up and say to someone who's from the council and going on about you, saying terrible and all this, how many tenants do you house and you have to pay your own mortgage? You're getting no subsidies from the state or having to take what you get in housing benefit and dealing with the vagaries of the housing benefit system. They don't. Those who do, and occasionally do, you see an almost a road to Damascus change in their whole attitude. One minute they're worse, and then they become that. And they're going, well, I didn't realize it was like that, Jim. I always enforced against landlords and thought they were bad. Now I'm a landlord myself. I've seen it totally different. And they're asking me for advice, which I'm happy to do. I'd give anyone advice and explain to them what they do. You know, the interesting thing about that, all of them who have ended up with a property, usually it's an inheritance that was a multi-let, have sold it within a year. They come back and say, I just couldn't hack it, Jim. I found I couldn't deal with this. The vagaries of the law, because they're public servants, if they got prosecuted for breaches of Housing Act or something like that, they could lose their job. And so I just can't cope with it. My pension is more important than having a property. Even though if they had a number of them, they could become financially independent. They don't take that jump. They hold on to their job too much, which I can understand. But I lost my, I didn't lose my job. I chose to leave, took early voluntary redundancy. But it really was a decision. If I didn't take it, I'd be pushed anyway. So not making a big point out of that.
What did you lecture in, Jim?
Law. Law was my main subject. I lectured in lots of things. I jokingly used to say I lecture in polyfilling because they had any cracks in the timetable to stick me in. Law lecturers, you tend to have the ability to absorb information and therefore they say, well, that's just a book. Read it and you can lecture it. So I ended up teaching all kinds of bits and pieces as well as law. Law gets
and also great. The law stuff that you taught, that's obviously stood you in good stead with what you're doing now.
No, it gets in the way.
Does it?
Oh, yeah. The trouble is you know the law, and that can cause great difficulty. You get things that you know is questionable legality. Other people who haven't got a legal background say, well, the person down the road's doing it, therefore I can do it. And I'm saying, no, you actually can't. I taught law, I taught tax, and I know what the rules are with tax. And people say, oh, this is a way of avoiding tax. It's okay because so-and-so accountant said I could do it. I said, no, it's illegal. Just because some people get away with robbing old ladies doesn't mean, say, that it's legal. And
I think that's come back and bitten a couple of people, hasn't it?
It has, times. Again, you've got to make your own decisions. Don't follow some...
I agree completely. So just to clarify on the splitting rooms then, so you can take up to six rooms without planning permission. So what you'll do is you'll take a four-bed, you'll convert to six beds, which is where the 50 grand in refurb cost comes in, putting the hardwired smoke alarms and the fire doors and all the rest of it. And then you'll calculate the rent, I don't know, £300 a month per room times six, that's 1,800 quid, times 12 months a year, whatever that works out to be. And then the commercial mortgage, which is a HMO mortgage, they'll multiply that by 10.
It was in my area by 10. You're absolutely right. It's dropped now. They'll only multiply it by 7 in my area.
Got it. So the annual rent, they'll multiply that by 7.
Yes.
So let's say that's 210, like you said, and then they'll lend you 70% against that 210.
Yes.
Got it. Perfect. That's fine. So for those people listening, if we've gone through those numbers pretty quick, you can hit the rewind button just to run through those. Because it can be quite complicated, can't it, Jim?
No, it's dead simple. The trouble is no one ever believes it. I do courses and say this is what you can do. Banks won't admit to doing that because it's too simple. Mortgage brokers won't say you can do it because they don't do it themselves and they don't understand it. And it's not quite as simple as that. Sometimes the net effect is what you've said is perfectly correct. You value on income, get your money back, go on to the next deal. But it's not quite as simple as I made out. There's a few twists and turns in it, but you end up with that. The net result is you end up that way. You're absolutely right. But it's not quite as easy as you're making out.
Yeah. Okay. And if people wanted to find out more about exactly how to do that, is there a book they can download? Is there a course that you've got on? Because we've got people who are like, that sounds awesome. That's exactly what I want to do. How do they get more information and get to find out exactly how you do it?
Right. Yes, I do courses. I've written a book on there. The leading book I've got is called How to Become a Multimillionaire HMO Landlord, which explains all this to you.
And where can you get that from?
Go on my website, hmodaddy.com. HMODaddy.com, How to Become a Multimillionaire HMO Landlord. That gives you the whole, virtually everything I know about how to become an HMO landlord. It's all the information of how to go to the finance, how to select properties, how to select tenants, how to adapt properties, and a lot more. You can also come on courses. I'd recommend you come on a course as well because reading a book is not enough. Or you could do a mentorship. That's where you do a one-to-one approach to it. Or I also now do JVs where I do it for you.
Okay.
I've stopped buying properties in my name, mainly because of the 2008 crash. I could see I could lose it. So it's better off that I work through other people and they own the property. And I just take a slice of the profit. Well, I don't. It's for the children. So that's the way I'm moving now. I'm not buying anymore in my name unless I can't find someone to JV it, which I usually can. So I'm helping other people. But yes, it's the information there to learn how to do it. But the other problem you got is you can't do it if you're cold, inexperienced. Mm. If you went to the bank and said, I want a commercial loan, one of the things they're going to look for is, where's your experience? It's a bit of a chicken and egg. Unless you're an experienced HMO landlord, you'll not get commercial finance. It may change next year. I've seen a great relaxation in lending criteria, even this year, that funding is getting easier and easier. It might tighten up again, I don't know, but you're getting other players coming in. They have different approaches. But for someone who comes in cold, commercial borrowing probably would be very difficult for them to get. However, if they came on a mentorship with me, I could get the finance because I would, or if they JV'd with me, I can get the finance because they're saying I'm managing the property, even though it's owned by someone else. And they'll take my experience to help them get finance and works that way.
And what's the plan for the sort of next 10 years? When are you going to take more of a backseat, or are you ever going to take more of a backseat? What's the sort of plan around that for you?
Yeah, I get up in the morning, I do what I want, which is very strange. And that's probably bad. I could be a lot more successful if I focused a lot more on my business.
I think, just to clarify there, Jim, I think what you mean is you could be far more financially successful.
Yes.
If that's what you did. Well, success is measured in different ways. So, for example, my level of success, although I'm financially successful in that I don't need to work for a living, get up and go to work, I have residual income. I've got a lot of time success. So, you know, like you, I wake up and do whatever I want. But to me, it's going canoeing or swimming in the sea or out on a bike or whatever. So it's just important for people to understand that there's different types of success. It's not always about the money. It's about being able to do whatever you want to do it. And it sounds like you're already there anyway.
Yes, I suppose I am. I'm a bit spoilt and I should put more effort into attending the business. Yes, I agree that success can be measured in many, many ways rather than just purely financial. But I could be far better. And it frustrates me because I like to do whatever you're doing, you like to do to the best of your ability. And because I don't concentrate on something, it's not run as well as I want to.
Do you know what I find funny? You say you can wake up and do whatever you want, but I bet you wake up and do more property.
Yes, I tend to concentrate more on talking about property. That's my great passion. Okay. So I've started writing, well, I've written, say, the How to Become a Multimillionaire. Last year, I wrote 4 books, which I got published just at Christmas. They're all, you can get them all off my website. I'm currently writing 3 more books, and I just like writing. I find that quite a interesting, exciting thing to do. And that tends to be the first thing I'd want to do when I get up in the morning. Then the rest of the day takes care of itself. I'm just dealing with problems at work, etc. I'm not complaining. I do what I want. I am trying to delegate the day-to-day running to other people and getting the right staff. And that's the biggest challenge I've got now, is getting the right staff to run the business. And I've gone through an enormous learning curve on that one. Even though I taught law, I studied management, nothing prepared me for dealing with staff.
Actual real life employees who need, you know, shoelaces tying, noses wiped. But it is like dealing, my children are 7 and 10 now, and having staff is just like having children.
Yeah. In that. It can be. And it can't be. It's a difficult, it's much more complicated than that. Yes, I accept you say your 12-year-old child, it could be far better than dealing with some staff. But it's a very complicated thing. And what I didn't pick up, I'm a bit slow on the uptake often. People would tell me, usually employees, this is what you should do with staff. And they haven't got a clue. And the people who have had staff rarely say anything apart from look at the ceiling or think it's bloody hard and they struggle. It's again, just as the social sector get away with murder and are paid vast sums of money to house people that the private sector do better at a fraction of the cost, the great unknown thing is employment and employees. Very few employers will stand up and say, actually, employing people is more like this. You talk, they go on about employment tribunals and employers exploiting employees. It's just like landlord and tenant. Most landlords are exploited by their tenants, and most employees exploit their employers. It's not the other way around.
It's not
the
pressure.
The pressure is completely reversed.
Yeah. So, how many properties have you got now?
Last count, it was 120 HMOs and about 30 single lets.
Amazing. And how many tenants do you manage?
It's nearly 900 now.
900 tenants. And how many staff have you got to manage that number of tenants?
It's gone up because I've just employed a lot more staff to improve the quality of my properties. It's probably hitting nearly 50 now.
50 staff?
50 staff, yes.
Wow, that's amazing, Jim. So in terms of the management of those properties, how many staff are directly in charge of managing those properties and making sure they're not empty and that sort of thing, as opposed to refurb staff?
Lettings, it consists probably of about 3.
Okay, so 900 properties are managed by just 3 people.
The lettings, no, the management. I've got 5 area managers who go around and check each property and deal with day-to-day complaints from tenants, make sure the properties are okay and safe. So there's 5 of those. If you're just doing pure lettings, if you want to let a property, there's 3 people who deal with that. They will interview you, do the viewings and everything else. I've got 1 person, two people who just deal with housing benefits. That's their, not exclusively, but the majority of their work is dealing with housing benefit and so on. There's various people in different roles. The biggest is the maintenance crew.
I've got it. Okay. And then the other question I've got as well is, you know, in I don't know how old you are, Jim. I'm not going to ask you. But in 100 years, when you're not around anymore, what's the plan? And hopefully you've got another 100 years left in you. So, as we all have. So what's the plan with, you know, all of these properties? Have you got a plan in place for passing these on?
Yes, I've got a plan. That's why I'm JVing. I've building up property dynasty to pass to the children, which gives me some qualms. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing.
I understand. Is it Duncan Bannatyne who... I think he said if his daughter comes a nurse, he'll double her income. Whatever income she gets, he'll double it because he doesn't necessarily need them to be entrepreneurs. But he's not leaving anything to her.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what he said. He says a lot of strange things.
Yeah.
it is a challenge that I've got to bring my children up. And if everything goes as successfully, they will not have to work to earn money. And I would hope that I could put them to do something that's not necessarily having to give up their time for money, but would do something worthwhile. There's a lot of things that you could do to change the world for the better. and put effort into it. And it wouldn't take that much effort to achieve these things. And I would hope they'd do that. But it's their choice. I'll leave it to them. They do what they're able to do, what they want, but not have to get up. And that is a benefit and also probably a great detriment. Because if I didn't have to work, I'm not sure what I would have done, if anything. And to spend my days just getting up to go for a meal, go and see friends, wouldn't have given me the satisfaction and achievement I have today.
It's finding that balance for them, isn't it, I think? My kids are 7 and 10, and so we sit down, we draw pictures of houses, and we'll say, you know, if this costs £200, but it's rented at £500, daddy makes £300, how many of those do I need not to work? Depends on what I spend. Mm. So we sit down, we do the pictures, and we've tried to get them at an early age to indoctrinate them from the way that the education system has indoctrinated them so far, where if you get up, you go to work and, you know, you earn a salary. Mm. And I think that's really important as parents to try and pass that on. And then the other thing that we do is we hand out backpacks to homeless people that have got like socks and pants and toothpaste and whatnot. And the kids come out with me and do that. So what I'm trying to teach them is two lessons. One is that you don't have to get up and work like everybody else. You just have to buy assets that puts money in your pocket and you do that right and you'll never be able to do that. But then what are you going to do with that spare time, which is then the second part, which is hopefully trying to teach them to go out and help other people.
Yes, I think you've thought it through a lot more. Do you think you help people like that by giving them stuff?
With the backpack won't change somebody's life. It doesn't give them a house or a room, for example. But what it does do, it gives them hope. At least that's the intention. And the hope is that, and we sit down, we have a little chat, we ask them why they're homeless. And usually, you know, they've made a mistake somewhere or they've been kicked out by the girlfriend who's cheated on them and they have no friends or whatever. And so we just sit down just to have a chat with them and just give them a few words of hope. And in the hope, from our point of view, that's going to help change them in some way positive. And some it will and some it won't. We have seen people, you know, we see the same ones over and over again and they've got bigger problems. But I think that we're just at the start of this journey with, it's called the Lufia Project, of helping people. I've actually written a 6-step system for dealing with homelessness, which I haven't published yet, and maybe I should. And it's about moving people, you know, into HMOs or even room shares, you know, with bunk beds, just to get them off the street into somewhere warm, and then into a room, and then into a shared flat, and then into the own house, using housing benefit as the method to pay for it. I'm happy to send you the document, actually, Jim, because I think you'd find it quite interesting in terms of what you do with your 900 tenants already.
What do you call it? What was it called again?
Which bit?
The Leaf something, you said.
The Lufia Project. Baby.
Lufia.
Yeah, Lucia. So it's a Spanish. Lucia. It's Lucia, because she's a Spanish baby, because she was born in Spain.
Yeah.
So it's, if you go to facebook.com/the Lufia Project, Lufia Project, I'll pop a link on the webpage when this
Yeah, I think that's good. As I say, anyone, as I said earlier on, if anyone comes to me and said, I want to work, I'm going home, and they're genuine. But the thing is, I find very few genuine people. Most of them just want a free handout and want out of con you. But yes, they will. And I get con left, right and center.
Yeah.
All the time. But yeah, I think that's great what you do. And that's fantastic.
I think, you know, for that one person that will take that bag and go, wow. And we've had people cry when we hand them to them because we've never had anything, you know.
Mm.
And if it just changes that one life, as a coach, I always see myself as being the pebble. Mm. When you throw me in the pond, I create ripples, and those ripples interact with other ripples. And that's me. That's my coaching, helping people interact with others and getting results. Mm. And if by handing someone a backpack, that can help that one person, even if it's just one person a year, then we've done well. But also, we're teaching the kids to help and go out of their way, that not everybody is as lucky as we are, that maybe we can help others and try and give them hope. Hope's a really powerful thing. I've been in situations, I'm sure you have, where I've had no hope. And I was laughing earlier because you mentioned about not having enough money for the electricity. And I've been there as well, where you're freezing cold, you've got your quilt, and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And I've been in those situations, like a lot of people have, and with no hope. And it's horrific. And you think about ending it and all the rest of it. And it's like, That's not what we're put on this planet for. We're put on this planet to be adventurous and to go out of our way and to really live life at the edge and have fun. And I think that's what you do in your own way, and that's what I do in my own way. But some people are not as fortunate as that, and they forget that that's what life should be. So maybe giving a backpack is a little bit of hope for them, you know?
I think that's fantastic, especially treating your children to have social service. It doesn't happen now. I was brought up that you should help others, to give time, it's charitable to work like that. But I haven't come across it very much since then. It somehow has gone out of our society. It's the state who has to provide, not local do-gooders. If you want, that's not being derogatory to help people and provide help. That's just seems to have gone. I think Maggie Thatcher put a stop to it.
I actually find it really objectionable that we even have to have things like charities to help homeless people. Mm. Because surely having a house is or shelter, it should be one of your basic human rights. And therefore the government are failing by people. And people go, well, they're homeless for a reason. And whilst I understand that, you know, they're purposely homeless. That's their decision. The people I've spoken to would give their right arm for a roof over the head, you know?
If you've got anyone in my area who wants a roof over the head, I've got plenty of vacancies. One of my bugbears is I've got an enormous amount of vacancies. I find it frustrating because I think I provide some of the best accommodation. Well, I do provide the best accommodation in the area. One thing.
Do you know what the problem is, Jim?
No.
The problem is that you can give someone a room or a roof over the head, and without the support services in place, it doesn't last because there are bigger issues. Usually it's a psychological issue.
Yes.
And unless society, stroke the government, can provide that level of support, which they refuse to do, which if you think about how many times a homeless person goes to hospital or goes in prison, I imagine it's significantly more. There's a cost there that they're not interested because it's not a bottom line cost. It's hidden in the balance sheet, if you like, because it's just NHS, you know, 4 billion quid or whatever it happens to be. It doesn't show up anywhere, even though we know it exists. So the government are not interested from that point of view. So unfortunately, for the homeless people, there is no way out of it unless they're getting some sort of support. Now, there are churches and homeless charities that do provide that level of support, and that's very good. But in our efforts to combine this work with charities, they're not interested either. They just want to go off and do their own little thing. And I've got a friend of mine who collaborates with charities to bring them together, to work together, and it's just a dead loss. They're not interested. And it's frustrating, I'll tell you. But we keep going, and if we can be the change that we want to see, then, you know, eventually it'll gain momentum. We've had people hand out backpacks in Birmingham, in Bristol, in London. We've probably been able to distribute about 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just for me, that's people in London who said, oh, I've just dropped 5 backpacks today. And I'm like, what? That's brilliant. I didn't even know they were doing it. And that's, you know, it's a really... It empowers other people to go and also be the change that they want to see as well, which I think is really good. And it's one of the reasons for doing this podcast is because if we can help more people get what they want, then they in turn can help more people get what they want, and so on and so on and so on. And if that can help impact society and make it better, then, you know, that's my little piece of work done, really, and yours and other people listening. So for those people who are still listening to this, it's like you've got an opportunity to go out and be the change that you want to see. Turn the telly off, go buy some backpacks, hand them out. It's not even difficult to do, you know.
That's right.
So,
well, you don't even have to do that. In our area, they're very lucky. They've got local churches. Last Christmas, I went along with a few of my staff, and we helped in the church where they provide Christmas dinner, and I supported it as well. Mm-hmm. And you could bring people in, and they do it every weekend. I'm not sure if it's every day or every weekend, where they provide food for people who are in need. And you can just go along, and what they're short of is someone who will listen to people and are sympathetic and non-judgmental. So you don't even have to do anything.
I bet, Jim, your work there never goes out on telly, does it?
No.
Surprisingly.
They don't. I mean, take something away from us. Do not believe anything you hear on the television or necessarily read in the paper. I've got very cynical. I stopped reading papers. I don't watch television for information most of the time. I just watch entertainment on television, treat it as it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, then, Jim, I think we're pretty much done, really. The important bit that I got to for me in this podcast interview was finding out a little bit more about what makes you tick, and also some of the good work that you do that you never hear about, you know? It's like looking under the bonnet and just finding all this extra stuff. It exists, but no one's ever asked you about it, or I've never seen anyone ask you about it. So that's why I wanted to get under the hood a little bit more.
Yeah, thanks very much. And same goes for training. I have people come and work with me for nothing. They don't pay me anything. I don't pay them either, but they want to learn the business. You come and do it. And you'll find that most successful people will do that kind of thing if you ask them. It's amazing how much generosity there is out there.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely agree. You have a choice, I think, in how you want to see the world. You can see it as a big bad thing that's full of evil, or you can see it full of goodness, light and beauty. Of course, there's the occasional idiot who'll try and ruin it for you. But generally, people want to go out and help other people, I find. But that's only because that's my perception now. When that wasn't my perception, that's not what I found at all. You know, when I thought it was a big, dark place, that's all I found. Big, dark people, you know, that were not very nice. Whereas now, you know, my perceptional shift there, and I see people want to go out and help them, and that's why, you know, asking people to come on a podcast is really easy because everybody wants to do it. Wonderful, Jim. Just on a personal point of view, it's great to catch up with you again. I always enjoy chatting, and I just really like to thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been really educational.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. All right, take care, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.